This is kind of a talk that's pawned off of a conversation I had at PumpCon a couple of years ago, where I tried to explain that what I do for a living isn't social engineering. And I said it wasn't, and I was wrong. It's playing the game of, like, can I hack a box? And I realized now that I'm a lawyer, I can actually make sysadmins hack their boxes for me. You know, like, hey, I would like to get the information on your systems, and I don't want to dig around. In fact, I'll just order you to find it for me. And if anyone's caught my talk at DEF CON or Layer 1, this is a more nuts and bolts approach that I've been sort of more thinking about. So, quick overview. Why is litigation an IT risk? Quick overview of civil litigation. How you guys can either help or hurt the situation. Some examples are war stories, as the case may be, and what I found does work and what really doesn't work. Disclaimer, I do not actually work for Microsoft Corporation. I don't know how that got to be on my name. I'm on that. I actually like to think of it as the curse of Lisa, that between setting in a proposal and actually talking at Lisa, for some reason the company I work for always seems to go out of business. So I'm currently looking. While I am an attorney, I'm not your attorney. This is technically not legal advice. It's merely the start of a conversation. And I like to think of it as a conversation that you'll end not with me, but with your organization's legal department. I've changed some names, mostly to protect the guilty and the incompetent. I'm mostly going to discuss U.S. federal law. State law is usually, on this matter of electronic discovery, is usually patterned on or very similar to, but there's always some little wrinkle that might make things more interesting. And by interesting, I mean bad. And this area of law is really in flux. Things are changing very, very quickly by our standards. So what's good today and perfectly legitimate advice today may be wrong a couple months from now. Okay, civil litigation is an IT risk. It allows outsiders, third parties who may not like you, to access all your stuff, all your sensitive information. It exposes you and your organization to potential financial losses, either through the litigation itself, through screwing up the litigation, sanctions, and the like. It also, though, tends to distract organizations. A large enough lawsuit against your company tends to have all the people that are making decisions stop. They're more about the litigation. So stuff like, we should upgrade some massive systems, we can't. We're in litigation now, and that's all we're thinking about. And I've seen numerous companies get hit with a fairly big lawsuit, and they never recover, even if they win, because the business stopped being about, we make widgets, we sell services, we do stuff. It becomes, we're just trying to beat this litigation. So, quick overview of civil litigation. Civil lawsuits, some dispute, it starts with a form called a complaint, which is not what we do to our spouses every day, but instead a long sort of detailed, you did this, 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 and this. Under this law, it's an action that I can sue for recovery. Discovery is the first big step in any civil litigation, and it's getting bigger because in a business litigation, what you do to prove your side or disprove the opposing side is all in documents. It's all in, you know, say, for example, a contract dispute. We want to see the contract. We want to see all the things you did in performance of that contract. We want to see all the things the other side did or didn't do. And that's usually in email. That's usually in office documents. That's often in printed documents. The way it's supposed to work is that each side produces all responsive information. Responsive means this is likely relevant to the claim. So say for a similar, you know, simple example, your company develops widgets. a bunch of your engineers jump ship and go to your biggest competitor, and all of a sudden their widgets look awfully familiar. You sue for unfair competition, you sue for maybe a patent case or a trade secrets case. You then have to go and divulge all of your information that you have about your widgets and maybe hiring policies and everything else that might lead to relevant information. The other side has to do the same to you. If you don't, if you hold something back that you were supposed to give over, there are sanctions, and I'll talk about those sanctions in a bit. But overreach and mistakes are common. Unfortunately, incompetence is one of the biggest driving forces, I think, in most of society. And here, incompetence does a lot of interesting things. The next step of discovery is what we call depositions, interrogatories, where you could actually question other people, either working for your company or working for third parties that may have useful information. That you can then get through a subpoena. A subpoena is effectively discovery against a third party. And then settlements or arbitration or trial or some way of resolving this. Like, we've all got this information, now what? Okay, you're not lawyers. What's all this got to do with you? The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, they're the ground rules. They're how we do lawsuits in the federal system. Recently were changed to require all electronically stored information that you hold in your possession to be given to the other side that's relevant. That's as discoverable as paper documents. Electronically stored information is rather vague, and I'll go into what that means in a little bit. But the two big rules are FRCP 26 and 45, the discovery order and the subpoena. When you're sued, you automatically have to give either all the lists, all the electronically stored information that you possess to the opposing side that is relevant to the case, or you just have to give a list of sources and their likely contents. You also have to disclose all important people that work for you that may have that information. Subpoena is I go to a third party with a court order to say, give me this information, and there's some ways they can fight it, but that's kind of out of the scope of this talk. You can limit a discovery order or a subpoena by saying it's either overly burdensome. You're suing me for $1,000. You don't get to have 10 million documents. Or it's privileged. There's something about the information that you cannot divulge it. It's meant to be protected. Often trade secrets, non-patented stuff that you're going to patent, some health stuff under HIPAA, attorney work product. So, what's electronically stored information? It's still open. It's a very vague term. Vague terms terrify me because you can get very easily sandbagged. There are some firm rulings that email is an electronically stored information has to get handed over. Digital documents, Office PDFs, that sort of stuff. Voicemail, if it's stored, can be forced over, and I've seen a few cases where they've not turned over voicemail, and the voicemail's actually been like a smoking gun. Usually sexual harassment cases often turn on less formal forms of communication, IMs, voicemails, and the like. Backup tapes are often fought over, and there's one or two cases where slack or unallocated space, they've actually required a forensic technician to show up, image a drive, and then do a fairly expensive forensic analysis to find, ooh, there was information, before you formatted this drive again. There's some weird precedent on contents of RAM as electronically stored information. I'm a little puzzled by stored because if you think of it, yes, it's technically stored, but it's not really for any length of time. There's the forced logging on public servers where they actually said, we're going to make you turn on logging. That's the Brunel via Columbia, or otherwise known as Torrent Spy, where they fought over a part of our discovery order is that we want you to start logging IP addresses of people using your systems. The people with the systems lost that because their argument was, it's overly burdensome, we can't do that, and in the in the order they reference the page of the manual from Microsoft about IIS, how to turn on logging. It's like, you know, click this tick box, done. So it wasn't really a way to say it's overly burdensome. Okay, how do lawyers think about electronically stored information? It's what we like to think of as custodian-based. I'm suing your company. There are five people that may have information. I think of it as this document was in so-and-so's hands. It doesn't exist unconnected to anybody, because that's often more important than what the document says itself. Email and e-docs are what people will talk about, because that's 99% of all electronic discovery. Email, self-explanatory, e-docs also as well. I'd like to call it presumption of printability. If it can be blown onto 8.5 by 11, it's probably something the lawyers like, because they're still in a very paper mentality. Even when they're fully electronic, they're still taking files, converting them to TIFF, and they're going through with like a web browser or a special package that looks like an image database, and just clicking through them to determine if it's of use or not. Sometimes the lawyers get creative, though, and start asking for stuff that isn't printable. I was in a case, not as a lawyer, as a consultant a couple months ago, where they fought over videos of paint drying. And I thought it was really sad that, you know, when people joke about, like, man, this is as boring as watching paint dry, I'm going, I'm watching a video of paint drying. Wow, like, this is meta boring. And it actually was important, because the whole case was about, like, this paint was special and did neat stuff. I'm like, wow, there's someone actually watching this and going, like, at 27 seconds into this, you'll watch as she says this thing about the paint. God. But sometimes there's relevant info there. Also, it's often done as this weird, many litigators will pull this, where they're attempting to just make you jump through hoops in a way to beat you up and bring you back to the settlement table, and they'll make these wide, sweeping discovery orders that's going to be, you know, we're talking about a $500,000 litigation, and you're talking $200,000 worth of discovery to get processed. No, you know, like, yeah, you know, we're going to have to go to a judge and maybe fight it, but maybe that'll just get me back to, like, let's, you know, work about writing a check to one another. So what happens with all the discovery, all the emails that might be relevant, all the e-docs? First step is what's called a litigation hold, where hopefully your corporate counsel says, stop deleting information about this. We have to hold on to it until some future date. Preserve all potentially responsive data. If you don't do this, your organization or you can get in pretty deep trouble. There's been some fairly heavy sanctions handed out for deliberate spoliation, where someone thought they were getting tricky and deleted a bunch of emails, and instead turns around like, no, you're getting fined, and I think several million dollars on a fairly small litigation too. Next step is collections. Go figure out who's got what, how do we get it, and put it all into one location so then we can process it. It's a very broad sweep. I've seen people go kind of nutty about this, and I understand why. It's because lawyers tend to be very, very, very risk adverse, especially when it isn't their money. The next step is what's called the discovery conference, where each side kind of works out when are you giving me this stuff? When am I supposed to give you that stuff? They discuss, now though, with the electronic discovery, there's a lot of, we have to talk about formats, we have to talk about both what format of the document's in, but also how, you know, are you giving me a DLT? Are you giving it on a hard drive? Are you making it available on a secure website that you keep? Who knows? The next step is the privilege and responsiveness review, and I'll go into this in the next slide of why it's got to be it is such an antiquated process that it terrifies me. It's, you have people look through all the documents that have been collected and determine whether or not they're privileged, whether or not they're responsive, whether or not they're relevant. The next step is production, where it's, here you go, other side, there's a bunch of documents. You know, here's 18 DVDs of all the email from all the people you wanted. Start reading. And then there's the substantive review, where each side then has to go through and go, what's this actually useful for? Why is Lit so expensive? And because every document, every email, every file gets reviewed by a human. Usually twice, at minimum. Once for privilege is, say for example, my company's being sued. There's all this email about the thing we're fighting over. I have a team of lawyers look through and go, is this otherwise privileged? Is this attorney work product? And 99.99% of all email is not to your attorney. It's because you're actually doing things that are productive. It's then read again for substance. Does this actually have anything to do with what we're litigating about? Then the substantive stuff, the important stuff, is re-reviewed in preparation. Review is performed by attorneys who are just graduated. They're not really technically lawyers. They just have a JD. Usually between $90 and $150 an hour is what you as the end user of that service will pay. Supervised by more senior attorneys, which charge a lot more money. There's no incentive for your law firm to reduce the costs because, one, they're risk adverse. It's kind of drilled into us in law school to say it is better to charge your client a lot of money than ever say you're sorry. Like, look, I thought of every possible bad thing that could happen. It's sort of like that Sam Waterston sketch about, like, do you have robot insurance? And it's that same, like, ooh, this potentially could, you know, 1 in 100 chance come back and bite us. Ooh, we need to spend a lot of money to figure out how that can. Also, because you're often talking about really expensive litigation. If you lose, you're writing a check for $40 million. So people tend to get, really scared when you're doing about that. Also, because this is often done as cost-plus billing on behalf of the law firm. So why should they want to reduce costs? Like, every $100 you're giving them, they're keeping 50 of it. So, yeah, you're right. We shouldn't do all this kind of scut work because they're billing for it. This is how, basically, to explain why it gets so expensive. What I like to call the $120 email. Hypothetical manager in your company, Alice. She sends one email with a 3-page Word doc to 5 people. Could be anything from sign-up sheet for someone's birthday, could be the new procedure for how we're going to store databases, whatever. Alice's company is in litigation, and her group is relevant to the suit. Oftentimes, lawyers would get very broad with that because lawyers are risk-averse, again, and it's not their money. So each email and each attachment is reviewed for responsiveness by a human, assuming a good doc reviewer can read about a page a minute. So that works out to $36 because 6 people, there's 6 copies of that document, there's 6 copies of that email, each has to get reviewed. Say, for example, it's marked responsive. Ooh, this actually is relevant. Say the case is about sexual harassment. One of Alice's employees is suing for sexual harassment. And this email was procedures about, like, our new HR procedures, something like that. So it's marked responsive. Ooh, this is of interest. We're going to have to give it to the other side. We're going to have to re-review it when we're preparing for depositions. So it's re-reviewed again by senior associates. Senior associates tend to make a lot more money. That's $250,000 a year. So to pay them that salary, they're billed out at between $250 to $300 an hour. I'm not including any cost if someone responded to Alice's email. If the email was like the smoking gun, which means it would be read again and again and again because they're trying to figure out, like, how do we, fight the, do nuance on this. So one email that you send to a couple people, if it's relevant to the litigation, will get churned over and over and over again by people billing fairly large sums of money. And think of all the email that might be on your servers. Think of all the documents that are on your file servers. I'm helping out with the litigation now where we are, I think we've hit the 1.5 million document. So there's a room like this filled with machines, filled with lawyers going, not responsive, not responsive, for 10 hours a day. They're billing the company out at $175 an hour. So think of a room filled with people working 10, 12-hour days billing that. And just that's taking wads of cash and setting it on fire. Both sides in this litigation are doing that. And that's why, you know, lots of companies, when you get into a sizable enough litigation, never really recover because they've just vomited money. So that was the mundane, boring parts. Now I want to talk about the stuff, if I haven't really scared you. Sanctions. When you deliberately or negligently destroy stuff. Say, for example, you don't read the litigation hold document that says, you know, one of Alice's employees is suing for sexual harassment. Don't delete any email they've ever sent. And you do. Or you just, Alice's employee changed her name halfway through. I deleted the old stuff. Oops. You know, all of a sudden you are now looking at, not you necessarily, but your company is looking at sanctions that can be either some of the opposing side's legal fees, including those doc reviewers going, not responsive, not responsive, at $175 an hour. Expert fees to recover data. I've seen a couple of those where they've hired forensics guys to go through and churn through. And then there's the really ugly stuff, the adverse inference, which means you can say, we think the emails that you deleted bolstered our complaint. We can claim in a court of law and get a jury to make the argument that says the fact that the emails are gone means they say what the opposing side says they did. So you can make evidence up because there's nothing there. That's usually, we get an adverse order, or a judge agrees to that. I've seen people go and go, yeah, we'll settle because we've lost. Dismissal of a claim, I've seen a few of those. I've seen a dismissal of a defense, which is we were going to raise this in defense of that, but because we've destroyed evidence, we lose the defense. Well, we might just have lost the case. And sometimes it's just absolute dismissal or an automatic loss. So, little aside on how it's also a privacy or security risk, the very aspects of discovery, because now, I mean, the old rule, the paper rule that we think of, that lawyers think about for discovery is anything that's in possession at work is the company's possession, and it only pertains to the company. Because, you know, think of it this way. 1968, you worked for General Electric and you wanted to write a letter to a friend. You didn't go and get GM letterhead and type it up. You personal stationery or just blank sheets of paper that you stole from the office. Nowadays, though, you might use your own email account to send an email to a friend. That has nothing to do with work. You may use your phone, your CrackBerry, to call up a friend. You also, though, it blurs the other way. You may be working at home on your own PC to do work stuff. So work is kind of bled into the home, and the home is bled into the work. So if you're dealing with personal stuff on company equipment, it's now discoverable. So you want to talk about, you know, your health problems because you're emailing a friend who's a nurse. All of a sudden, and I've read these emails, you know, looking at a doc review and seeing, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with the case, but it somehow bled in. And I'm reading about a woman's, woman's cancer treatments. Oops, you know, someone was incompetent and didn't filter that out before I knew about it. Also, the broad discovery sweep. Usually people doing collections just grab everything. I've done that. The one litigation I was helping out on, I was doing the actual collections, the forensic collections, and one guy just dismissively said, I don't sort anything out. You go grab it. So I grabbed, I think he had 8 years of email. I imaged his entire drive. And so we found, we'll just say inappropriate JPEGs, and all of a sudden that was like, hey, you know, we now know your interests. okay, you know, I'm not touching your keyboard again. But it was one of those, you know, you've opened yourself up because we came in with we're gonna sweep really wide. But the problem is that you're also now taking all those private emails. They're no longer in your company. They're going to a law firm. They're actually, though, going to be handed off to third-party vendors for processing, from turning the email into a TIFF so a doc reviewer can click through them. It's handed off to someone you don't know about. You've never heard of these companies. oftentimes, in having worked in the e-discover as an e-discovery vendor, stuff is laid off between companies all the time. Like, I'm booked, I have no capacity for processing, but one of my competitors down the street has capacity. I'll lay the work off on them, brand it, put my own brand on it, and, you know, he'll take a discount because we all do it, because sometimes I'm booked, sometimes, you know, I'm empty. So you're taking fundamentally private things often and just handing them willy-nilly to third parties. And we don't think about security. I hate to say it, in these companies, no one talks about security because it's like, who wants this information? Well, someone did. They're suing for it. Also, I like to think of the loyalty of short-term contractors may be questionable. I have seen stuff. One case I'm working on, there is some financial data, and I thought if I was not so possessive of my bar ticket, I could probably do a little insider trading. Like, interesting. Like, you know, maybe it's the, you know, going to too many hacker conferences where I'm like always looking for the angle, but it was an interesting problem. Like, you've handed over all this, you know, the stuff that your security people sweat at night because they don't want this to get outside, and instead someone like me is walking in saying, gimme, and I'm just going to give it to some people who, I don't know, whoever's the cheapest this week. Also, humans make mistakes. Back to that work bleeding into the home, home bleeding into the work. Personal information all the time goes past privilege and responsiveness reviews. Most of the times it's kind of funny, but, you know, I'm sure someone's going to slip up and put banking information or healthcare information again in these cases, and you're losing a lot. Okay, so I've been kind of rambling on about the law and why people are sometimes make mistakes. What can you guys do? And I tried to lay this out similar to an article I wrote for Login, where it's, if you think of each stage, you guys can help in a certain spot. Pre-litigation, I like to think of this as the happy time. This is project time. Nothing is on fire right now, so you can think about later stuff. First thing to do is what I like to call an ESI audit. And it's no different than any other audit of all your stuff. You could just bolt this on to your regular auditing. What do you have? Think of everything that holds electronically stored information. Stuff that people usually don't think about are old machines that you've got in the basement that you keep for parts. You don't wipe the drives. You just leave them there because, like, I might need that drive later. I might need stuff. So it gets wider. You get with people who what you want to do is you want to determine, are your end users using home machines? Are those potential sources of ESI that you would have to give up to the other side? Consider everything. Think very broadly when you're doing the audit. Work out a retention policy, and it's actually a lot harder than it sounds, because I've seen people who've written retention policies and, like, I couldn't follow this as an IT guy. I have no idea how I'd make this happen. And I want to remind people of Fields Law. Stupid retention policies make things worse. One company, I met some of the admins, and they said, we're perfectly safe. We have a 20-day retention policy on emails. Like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That means every important email is getting printed to paper and stuck somewhere. So all of a sudden, finding that document is now riskier, because you're gonna have to go talk to that employee if you want that data, and it's in his or her filing cabinet. Hopefully, if it looks like my office, it's in a pile. You know, like, it's that binder or that binder. I don't know. So all of a sudden, you've taken a nice, easily searchable block of stuff and made it unsearchable and more expensive to go through. Also, following your own policy, I found the worst people for actually, you know, doing retention, doing destruction are the IT staff. We would, I mean, because come on, like policy is for other people. You know, no personal computers. You know, you're not allowed to bring in your personal laptop. Well, except for the IT staff, because we all, you know, we have to have the hottest and fastest. So we're bringing, you know, I'm guilty of that. I'm sure half of the people in this room are. And we, so it's often a, IT staff will often keep stuff. Case in point, I'm thinking of are like backup tapes. You often spool a one-off backup run for something that you've got in the back of your head and you don't want to make it like add to like the big log of backups, because it's like, no, it's just for this one thing in case that goes belly up, and I'll just leave the DLTs on a shelf and they'll be labeled something clear like that thing or blue. Use policies. Just think about remote access, think about use of personal email accounts, and figure out some way of saying, look, you don't really have privacy on this because we may have to discover it, and figure out a way around that. One company did it really interestingly. They just offered standalone machines with web access that you could, if you want to go check your email, go to that machine. We don't monitor it, so we're not responsible for any of the data on it. Kind of a neat little way of handling. So you never had to worry about all that ESI. You never had to worry about information going out that might have to be brought back for discovery. Yes, you do have some risk with trade secrets might go out through that same pipe, but you know, it's what do you want to risk more? Also, more pre-lit ideas. Implement a collection plan. If you're sued, how do I get the information from that remote sales team? How do I get it from the satellite office? How do I get information from even the people in your home office? Remote collection's awfully nice. Having done one where I basically for a month I flew in and out up and down the East Coast, showing up with a USB drive and plugging in and grabbing stuff, being able to like fire off a remote script to go pull the data would have been great. You may actually already have those tools, because the tool that lets you collect data is also probably the same thing that lets you push out patches, that lets you determine what version, you know, for licensing. I'm thinking of if you know, like NetOctopus, like, oh, you know, that's the serial number of that machine. Oh, that, you know, that's out of warranty. We should probably swap that out. The same tool might be used to be able to do collections, so you don't have to go and buy or create a new tool. Specialized tools, I found, are expensive, unreliable, and clunky. I did some testing on some remote tools that I just wrote these scathing reports on because they're junk, you know. And for something as simple as get over the network, log into a machine, and pull data, that's been done. That's not rocket science. You're not doing anything magical there. And instead, these were like $10,000 a seat license packages that ran in Java. Like, why? You don't want reliability? And it was like bad Java, so it broke half the time. Like, that's not reliable, and you're charging me $10,000 for this. Consider the security risks. Anything that can collect that data can be compromised. I've realized that people don't think about that, at least people in my field don't think about that. We did one where we installed basically it's this big Linux box that scours networks and dumps, and it's like, has anyone tried to pen test this? And the response was, well, no, why? It's like, this is a device that has root level access on all the boxes, and yeah, no one would have any interest in that. File servers. Search and collection packages are out there, but if you're creative, you can go cheap. The first time I did this was working with Mike Steves, and he wrote, I think it was, four lines of shell script. It wasn't even a shell script to do a collection, and it worked really well. I've seen tools that do that for $20,000. It's like we put an OS 10 box, didn't even rack it. It was in my cube. It logged in as root against all of our file shares, ran a script looking for files with this, 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 or this. If so, copy, dump to these directories, done. took like 8 hours to run, and we had done a collection. So since then, I've just been reusing what he did. Other people use these very expensive tools that do the same thing. It's like, why? But always consider the security risks. Oftentimes, these are running as root, and you're risking a lot if it gets compromised. Backup systems. For your document retention policy, add backups. Just figure out what you're going to do with them. Consider create. Your backup system is most likely a really good tool to do these because you probably already have it. Dumping big chunks of stuff to disk or to tape or whatever you're using for backup, like this is the same thing. Apply the retention policy to backups, including those one-offs. It's okay to do one-off backups because you're backing up the CEO's personal machine. Okay, well, yeah, because I'm going to work on it. If I screw it up, I'm fired. Well, okay, spool it to backup before you do it. Great, but make a note of it. So that way your boss never, you know, when they're responding to one of these audits or to a discovery request, doesn't go, oh, that's all there is, and then a tape shows up. That's terrifying. Also, pre-lit, you can consider equipment purchases. Look for stuff that might be able to be easily collected against. Using a common format. I'm thinking of the last time I dealt with this was a voicemail system. If it can dump in a format that everyone recognizes, great. So you can easily give it to the other side. It's like, yeah, it's all on MP3 or AIFF or whatever, like as opposed to something proprietary. So you can quickly spool off that stuff and hand it over. Okay, next stage. We're no longer happy. Litigation is either likely or filed. This is under the new rules that if you know or should know that you're about to be sued about something, you have to instigate a litigation hold. Test it. It's like a backup. You don't know the backup's working until you actually run it and go pull files from it. Cooperate with the lawyers, but make sure everybody's realistic. And if someone isn't being realistic on either side, stay in the room and hash it out. Because, and I'll tell a war story about this where they weren't and it broke everything. Now is probably the time to ask for additional storage space because the lit hold is preserve everything that is relevant to this. So it might be something of fair amount of data that you have to spool off and dump somewhere. Asking for a cheap raid at that time is probably a really good idea because the corporate is in pain because they have to do this, and it's like, look, you're paying a law firm $1.5 million. Can I have $250,000 for a bunch of disk? The next step, Rule 26 conference. This is where the lawyers get together and say, here's how we're handing it over, here's what we're collecting maybe, here's what formats it's going to be in. Work out cost and time estimates. How much is this going to cost? How much time is it going to take? Because you might want to do this to argue it's overly burdensome. Or actually, you won't argue that it's overly burdensome. The lawyers will. Assist in working out the technical plan for it. How can we do this delivery? When do you want it? What formats? And also, I've found this, it's getting more and more interest in the legal communities. They like to bring a techie who knows their own systems, but also has a familiarity with the systems used by the opposing side to be able to call bullshit on them, to say, you aren't, it's not that difficult to do, and if you want, I'll go over there and fix it. I think it'll be fascinating to show up at one of these and actually do that, surrounded by lawyers, and you're going, no, here's how you configure notes to dump the mail. I've done it. Also, you can help select third-party vendors. Ask to do a security audit or to see if what they know about security, and get a feel for them because this is the last time you're going to have to be able to control that chunk of this business, and your input will be valuable at that time. Okay, litigation's commencing, collections, going and getting all that stuff that you've hopefully held. You're locating the sources, you're collecting with minimal intrusiveness. I found that having third parties are usually not as nice about it. They'll just show up and go like, I'm taking your hard drive. It's like, but that's the CFO. you know, can't just like yank his hard drive. Versus you guys, you already know these people, can go, you know, can I show up? Can I do this? Can I pull the data? Thank you. Done. Interact with the vendors to make them help. Since you're the one person representing your company that says, I think we should try to reduce costs now, and I know how to do it. Deduplication of identical files. This is radical new technology in my field where it's they just do an MD5 hash of all documents, and then if they have the same MD5 hash, well, we have two copies of the same document. We don't need to review it twice at $120. So you can also consider, you can use that to reduce the amount of documents you're going through. Assisting with unusual formats. You guys know your systems. You guys know that weird database written by, you know, that intern who's also strangely gifted, who, you know, like, it works. Don't look at it funny. Really, don't. And that's how, like, your purchasing database works. And it's like, we've looked for replacements, but they don't work. So you know how that works. You know how to output it. You might be actually really helpful in being able to sort through the little problems that always pop up. Identify and quantify the expensive stuff. That box of 9mm tape, those old Mac six, you know, Mac Quadras rusting away in your basement, like how much is that going to cost to slap and get the data off of them? And then at a deposition, explain under oath what you did to collect it all. Okay, one war story. I've changed the name of the company, so I don't want you, you know, selling them short. They were a really, really large, residential, mostly life insurance. They get hit with a class action suit in 2005. They're running a big EMC with Tivoli Storage Manager at 30% capacity at the start of litigation. The lawyers issue the vaguest lit hold order I've ever seen. It's overbroad. It basically says preserve everything. They had a weird... the problem was is that the disk shares and work groups were not one-to-one. You're in quality assurance, so you should have this share. Oh, wait a minute, but you're in that building, so you actually go to this share. So we couldn't figure out who, employee A, we don't know what shares they can access or that they're using. So people were duplicating efforts, and they're preserving so much data. I was finding some folders as many as 160 copies of the same folder. Basically, the way it turned out, though, was at the end of it, I seem to have deleted some parts of my slide. They are running at 99% of capacity. They are actually losing files off the bottom of the stack. As they're creating new ones, they're not deleting old ones, and they are going to face a nasty, nasty, nasty discovery sanction for this because they were preserving everything and weren't spooling it off to another disk. They asked for, we want more disk, and the response was, this is only temporary, deal with it. And I couldn't get the IT people to go talk to the lawyers because that was like I said that and it was like, you know, why don't you just go call the Pope? It was really, really, really strange. And we got called in because their lead sysadmin had quit and had not gone to another IT company. He's now running a Domino's Pizza because he clearly saw the writing on the wall and said, I'm out. This is going to be bad because the disk is at capacity. Their nightly backups were taking 28 hours. So what they were then doing was stopping them. Because, oh, and it's like, you can't do a recovery off of this. You don't know if these are good. When was the last time you've actually sampled one of your backups? And the response was December 05. It's like, oh dear. You know, this terrifies me. I know now why the system and just like, I'm out. This is terrifying me. And it terrified me. And my solution was I want to get the IT people and the lawyers in a room together, lock the door until they understand all their issues. Instead of working for a consulting company. So it's instead like, no, we're going to come up with a $150,000 kickoff meeting. Like, great. Okay. Few things that work. Preparation, always, always, always. Add discovery preparation to your existing audits. Simple. Save users and permissions lists so you know who has access to what. It's pretty simple. Build systems to search against your existing shares. It's cheap. It's easy. And doing it now when you can kind of do it at your leisure is better than doing it at crunch time. Sensible and enforceable doc retention policies. Make sure that they are enforceable. Make sure that people can live with them. You know, remember the rule about, you know, like everyone has to have a secure passphrase, and we're changing it daily. Means that Post-it notes will have passwords on them. Like you have to realize that we're dealing with people. Decommissioning procedures are now far more important because you have to know when you junk a machine what happened to the data. And you can, if you're not under some regulatory or litigation hold, you can safely say, if it's a part of your printed policy, you know, we're getting rid of your old machine, drive's getting wiped, done. Whatever's on it's gone. That's still safe as long as you're following that procedure. So that way, you know, 3 years from now, if you're dragged into court and like, oh, you deleted that, I'm like, well, it's our procedure. We didn't know we were being sued then. Talk to the law department. It's not that difficult. Try walking over and saying hi. Because lawyers are watching the opposite side of this, what I'm talking about. They're going and seeing these terrifying CLEs from litigation support companies going, are you ready? And they're you know, blood-curdling. I've taught a few, and I try to make them blood-curdling. So they've got this in their head, and if they don't know that they can go to you, they're going to go bring in an outside consultant who is going to screw your stuff up. You know your stuff better than they do. You can just kind of say, hi, I hear you got this problem. Maybe. Documentation and policies. I hate to make that more boring, but that often helps. Because that way you can say, how do you know this happened? Because that's the standard procedure. Stuff that doesn't work. Fiefdoms with and around the organization. Back to that insurance company. Because they wouldn't talk to one another, they're risking probably something that might put them out of business. Might have, because they knew they're spoliating this evidence. That may put them under. Leaving things be. That big box of tapes that you don't know what they are, it might be time to say, yeah, they're past the document retention policy. You know, erase them, reuse them. You know, as opposed to just having stuff lurking around that you don't know what it is. Documentation policies, if they're not followed, are deadly because you can get beaten up for, isn't that suspicious that you didn't follow the policy on this one time? You're normally supposed to keep stuff for 3 years. You deleted all this person's files. What were you trying to hide? You're going, it was an intern. They screwed up. But you want to have, you know, if you didn't have the documentation and policies and go, like, we delete stuff when we feel about it, it's not suspicious. If you have a standard operating procedure that you're not following, it's something that can get you. Any questions? I'm sorry, that went a little bit fast. I guess the only other thing I can think of to kind of hit you guys with is, actually, no, I already talked about that, the insurance bit. If that's it, thank you much.